Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Alia Bilal, who is the author of Temple Folk, the winner of the 17th Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. Bilal was born and raised in Prince George's County, Maryland. She has degrees from Oberlin College and the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. She's published many short stories and essays, and her first book of stories, Temple Folk, was a National Book Award finalist. She is also the recipient of a Whiting Award. Today, we're very happy to talk to her about her most recent honor, the 17th Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. Congratulations, Alia, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, in Temple Folk, you have introduced us to a whole world, part of the Nation of Islam, and I'm very curious to know how your family is part of that world and where that writing came from experience, from research, from a combination.
Well, my family was first introduced to the Nation of Islam through my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, who converted alongside my grandmother in the late 1950s. And my family remained part of the Nation of Islam until it disintegrated in 1975. However, we are a military family as well, and so they were abroad during much of the upheavals of the 1960s with the assassination of Malcolm X, et cetera. But after 1975, my family became Sunni, as did the majority of nation members who remained under Elijah Muhammad's son's leadership. And so I was raised Sunni, and it was always this interesting subtext of our family conversations, their experiences in the Nation of Islam. Most of those conversations I had with my father, because he was someone that, you know, I think enjoyed his experience in the Nation of Islam because of the ways it imparted discipline. But my other family members, the vast majority of my aunts and uncles, I would say, were really traumatized by their experiences. And I was always curious about this balance of the negative and the positive that were reflected in my family's memories. The stories themselves are entirely imagined, so they don't really have much at all to do with the exact experiences of my family members, but they are inspired by certain themes of experience.
Now, these characters, I love these characters so much. They seem like members of a huge family, even from story to story, with all that that entails. They fall in and out of love. They run away. They run away from the church. They run away from each other. They care for relatives who've just gotten out of prison. They go to funerals. They catch up with old friends. This is a great surging mass of humanity that you've packed into 10 stories.
Thank you. I conceived the collection in this way. I wanted it to be one community that you could see evolve across time. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be this family feel about the stories, because even though there are no explicit connections between the stories, this is one community of people that are living lives that are connected to each other. There is only one character who explicitly appears in a few of the stories, and that is Imam Salim, who pops up in Candy for Hanif, and he pops up in Woman in Niqab, and obviously the last story of the book, Due North, is all about his life. But everybody is connected in this book. You know, I guess that's the challenge with short story collections. Sometimes when they're not interlinked, it's like you can walk away from the book feeling like this is a scattered collection. Whereas with this book, I'm just hoping that a reader can feel they've had the opportunity to look at a single community, but from a variety of angles.
Right. Now, this is also a community that is in the throes of change, and that always makes for great fiction. I especially love the contemporaneity of dating apps in Niqab. Would you talk a little bit about writing that story?
Oh, sure. What inspired that story was my perusal of the Bible. I started reading the Bible seriously about 4 years ago, and I was really shocked by a lot of the stories that I found in the Bible. And one of them that stood out to me was the story of David and Bathsheba. And I just thought, this is really scandalous. This is like this revered figure in Jewish and Christian history. And yet in the story of David and Bathsheba, he has this adulterous affair with this woman and kills her husband, or orders her husband killed. And so I wanted to write a story around that, but also just to provide a portrait of Muslim normalcy for readers so that they can see where this young woman is moving from one extreme to the other extreme. You know, this kind of immorality that she sees within her parents' Christian church to falling into the arms of a man who may or may not be some kind of Muslim extremist guy. But as she's making that journey from one extreme to the other, right in the middle, there are just these normal Muslim people who are just living normal lives. I try to tell people all the time, you know, the vast majority of Muslims in our world, they want their children to go to good universities. They want their children to get good paying jobs. They want to smell good and look good and have beautiful homes. You know, they're as materialistic and, you know, worldly as the rest of us. And so I just wanted to provide the reader a portrait of what it means to really be Muslim in this world where this faith is so often maligned.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Alia Bilal, who is the author of Temple Folk, the winner of the 17th Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. As with any story of community, I think, you know, and it's something we're very attuned to here in New Orleans, you explore foodways. And foodways are so rich and interesting to read about in fiction. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the Kitchen Sisters, who show up from time to time, because they are such endearing, irritating, wonderful, funny characters.
Yeah, so that does come from life in a sense. The characters themselves are invented, but the culture of women cooking in the masjid is something that I remember from my childhood, and I think this is something that you see really across religion, at least in America, where predominantly it's women who are putting meals together in church kitchens and synagogues, etc. But these women don't think they were as valued as they should have been, because without their contribution, I think life in that masjid where I grew up would have been really, really dull. And I think that's part of what shaped the conceptualization of Candy for Hanif, which was initially called Kitchen Sisters. That was the title of that story. It was just this lingering sense that I had that, you know, whenever people talk about this space, they're always referring to the imam, they're always referring to the male leadership,
right?
Whereas the women really play the most pivotal role in keeping people happy, you know?
And they're so sharply observant of each other.
Oh, yeah.
And critical.
There's a real kinship between them.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a sense, they're all each other has. You know, they're friends and they work together and they understand each other's rhythms. And you kind of see them as a unit, in a sense. They function as one.
And then in Who's Down is the wonderful story of a father who becomes a vegetarian. So yes. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that story.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that story came to me in an afternoon. I sat down and I didn't know what I was going to write, but it just poured out of me. And in an hour or two, I was done writing the story. And I was just thinking about the group, the African Hebrew Israelites, who have a very interesting history. You know, this is a group that emerges in Chicago. And in the 1960s, their leader, who adopts the name Ben Ami Ben Israel, he has a vision and takes his entirely African-American congregation from Chicago to Liberia. And then from Liberia, they migrate to Israel on tourist visas and petition the Israeli government to acknowledge their claim that they were descended from the house of one of the 12 tribes of Judah. It's just a really curious claim that they make, and one that many people disbelieve. You know, how can they claim to be Jewish? How can they claim a place in the state of Israel when they have such a tenuous argument? And so that was like a perfect setup for the story.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have a young man who's making a claim, but who has this history. He's African-American without proven Jewish ancestry, and yet he would say that that land is his, you know? And it just seems like it's kind of a dangerous story because I don't know that everybody is familiar with that movement and how Black people who are Jewish and who have assumed that lifestyle can be marginalized in the conversation when the focus is on a group such as that, you know. So, yeah, it's a really delicate story, especially in these times where there's so much anti-Semitism happening mm-hmm. in the world right now. But I think there's some readers, they see, like, okay, yeah, these people, it's kind of a cult and they claim to be Jewish, but are they really? So, yeah, that's sort of what that story is about.
These are amazing stories because you don't ever lecture. You invite people to learn and to understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've been told that several times, but then I try to think, you know, I'm trying to think of the fictional works that I enjoy where there is this didactic tone. I think my approach is really just about trying to bring a character to a place where they have to confront themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all of us, fictional characters and real life people like you and me, we're often hiding from the truth of our lives. And we find these clever ways to convince ourselves and to convince the people that love us that the things that are blatant and in front of their faces aren't really there until life forces us to confront, you know,
mm-hmm.
our blind spots. And I think all of the characters in this book in some way are having to confront themselves and then make some decisions about what they see. You know, am I going to change or am I going to perpetuate this dishonesty in which I've lived all of these years?
You said in one conversation you worried you weren't very funny, but this to me is a very funny book.
Oh, thank you. I'm very proud of that. I think the book is funny in my own opinion. I mean, readers want so many different things, and that's been one of the major life lessons that I've learned in publishing the book is that, you know, I can do the work and know that the quality is excellent and that I really worked hard to make it very, very literary. But at the same time, readers you know, come with their own expectations and desires in the same way that I can hear polka and hear the virtuosity in polka music, but I don't particularly enjoy
it. Right.
You know, and so people approach my writing the same way. Something I am very convinced of at the same time is that the stories are funny. I know the stories are funny. I don't think I'm particularly funny in real life.
But on the page.
Yeah, on the page, I'm able to have this repressed funniness come forward for whatever reason. That's always something I tell people, like, if I had a career outside of writing, I would love to be an interior designer or a comedian or a DJ. Any of those three things I wish I could be, but...
And all very different.
I mean, yeah, it's just very different. But the comedy comes forward on the page for me.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Alia Bilal, who is the author of Temple Folk, the winner of the 17th Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. Now, I'm curious, right out of the gate, you got such terrific acclaim and such a great response to these stories. What does this particular award mean to you? What is special about the Ernest Gaines Award?
There are so many things about this award that take my breath away, frankly. Ernest Gaines is one of the first novelists that I read growing up. In high school, all of us read, you know, the autobiography mm-hmm. of Miss Jane Pittman and various other books of his, The Gathering of Old Men. And what I loved about his work was just how plain-spoken it was. And how dignified it was. You know, yeah. I didn't feel that he was portraying the lives of these people in a way as to make them small. They were grand in his conception, but also really loved the approachability of his stories. Again, like that thing of the writer writing to show off or to convince people of their brilliance. I didn't see that. There's clearly a brilliance there. But his craft wasn't showy in that way. He's just telling a lovely story. And so to be honored in this way, it just makes me feel that perhaps the judges felt like I write in a similar vein, you know, where the work is approachable, but also it can be taken serious mm-hmm. and it also can stand the test of time. But it's also just meaningful because of the judges themselves, you know, the makeup of the board. I just really respect these people. And the idea that people of that caliber would look at my work and see something great in it just means the world to me.
Well, there's so much that's great in it. So the thing about Ernest Gaines, though, to me, is that he was not just a great writer. He was a great man, you know, and I feel... he would have loved this book. I feel sure he would have loved this book.
You know, that's something that I think about and that brings me sadness. I just think about all of the writers who I've admired, who have passed on, who will never know my name, and who I would love to have had an opportunity to just shake their hand and tell them how much their work meant to me. But that's, I guess, not what's going to happen with those writers in particular. But
well, think about the writers in the future who will read your work and miss you.
Yeah, I can only dream.
You can only work.
Yeah, I can only work. And I just don't have any grand sense. I just feel like all of the celebrities, the real greats, have lived and died already, you know? I think the rest, and I don't see myself in that light. I just see myself as a person with some competencies and, you know, that I'm in a position now where I'm able to share that work, but I don't see myself like an Ernest Gaines, you know? I just I mean, I see myself as doing very serious and important work, but the grand portraiture, he's on stamps.
And they're right.
He's such a big deal. And to me, I'm just like working hard, still in the trenches. I have certainly not arrived.
Well, congratulations and thank you for all the work you have done. Alia Bilal will receive the 17th Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence Wednesday, October 23rd at 6 at the Manship Theater at the Shaw Center for the Arts, 100 Lafayette Street in Baton Rouge. She will read from and sign her book, RSVP at ErnestJGainesAward.org. Alia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. John Vircher reads from and signs Devil is Fine, Saturday, October 19th at 2 at Baldwin & Company. Blue Cypress Books presents an evening of poetry with Marie Timbresa, author of Sustenance, 50 Poems and One Love Story. Along with featured poet Kay Murph, Saturday, October 19th at 5:30 at Blue Cypress. Shannon Kelly Atwater and Alexander Navarre Davis read from and sign Clyde the Giant Crawfish, Sunday, October 20th at 11:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Rachel Mulholland discusses and signs The Birds, the Bees, and the Elephant in the Room, talking to your kids about sex and other sensitive topics, Sunday, October 20th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Chris Granger, Susan Langenhennig, John Pope, and Daniel Del Sol discuss and sign the new book from the Preservation Resource Center, Painting the Town, Wednesday, October 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Alia Bilal will receive the 17th Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence, Wednesday, October 23rd at 6 at the Manship Theater. That's at the Shaw Center for the Arts in Baton Rouge. She will read from and sign her book, RSVP, at ErnestJGainesAward.org. Allison Fensterstock discusses and signs How Women Made Music, A Revolutionary History from NPR Music, appearing in conversation with Jamie Attenberg, whose new book is A Reason to See You Again. That's Thursday, October 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Sebo Campbell reads from and signs Sky Full of Elephants, Thursday, October 24th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. And coming up, the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their big book sale Friday through Sunday, October 25th through 27th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Friday and Saturday, October 25th and 26th from 10 to 7, and Sunday, October 27th from noon to 5. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area, with more than 65,000 items for sale. Time to vote for the next one book selection? Cast your vote at the Facebook page or the website for one of the following three finalists: Letting in Air and Light by Teresa Tumanello Brader, Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy by Brooke Champagne, or Daughters of the New Year by E.M. Tran. And here's a very special reading group. Xavier University of Louisiana, Southern University of New Orleans, and Dillard are joining forces to host a series of groups focused on the works of acclaimed scholar Sadia Hartman, leading up to her visit to New Orleans in spring 2025. The series will explore four of Hartman's seminal works, each at a different institution. It begins at Xavier with a discussion of Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of the Riotous Black Girls, Troublesome Women, and Queer Radicals. Friday, October 24th from 6 to 8 in the Civic Center on the first floor of Xavier University of Louisiana Library. Discussion will be led by Robin Vander, Associate Professor of English and African American and Diaspora Studies. And get ready for the Louisiana Book Festival coming up November 2nd, 9 to 4 in downtown Baton Rouge at the Louisiana State Capitol, the State Library of Louisiana, the Capitol Park Museum, and the surrounding park area. The festival is free and open to the public, with more than 200 authors coming to entertain readers of all ages, along with activities for children and teenagers. This is the festival's 20th year. The Louisiana Writer Award will also celebrate its 25th year. This year's recipient is Baton Rougearian native poet David Kirby, longtime professor at Florida State University. And the festival's 15th One Book, One Festival program, led by Dr. Gary Richards, will feature Eudora Welty's The Optimist's Daughter. Author and illustrator William Joyce will debut the anxiously awaited Rocket Puppies, his first book in 8 years. And Ashley Elston returns with her adult debut novel, First Lie Wins, a New York Times bestseller, the Penguin Random House's best fiction book for the first half of the year, and the January pick for the Reese Witherspoon Book Club. The festival will also host the premiere of Books Across America, a documentary from filmmaker Mason Engel. He travels to 50 states, reads 50 books, and interviews 50 authors in 50 days. Among those interviewed is Louisiana's own Maurice Carlos Ruffin. For more information about the 2024 Book Festival, visit louisianabookfestival.org or check out the festival's Facebook page. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.